we have this massive economic system that's fucking gonna destroy the entire planet.
Even if we overthrow, let's say hypothetically, this entire economic system and institute something brand new, I think we're probably just gonna get caught in the same traps, ultimately speaking.
We have millions and millions of people working as slaves to basically subsidize our standard of living.
The more you look at these problems and the more you think about these problems, well, the more bleak things do seem.
We will reach these planetary boundaries. There will be instability as a result, and there will be some level of collapse.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Radius of Reason, a podcast where we discuss the various existential threats faced by humanity. My name is Andre, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Levon.
After podcasting about the meta crisis for a full year, we wanted to take some time to reflect on everything we've learned and kind of our thoughts about it as we head into the new year. Enjoy. For me, this is the big takeaway. To do something about a lot of these issues, whether it's climate change or, you know, wildlife devastation and artificial intelligence and all this shit, you have to address the economic incentive. And currently, the inertia of infinite exponential growth on a finite planet, there's like no stopping it. Like, what are you going to do? Like, seriously, what are you going to do? Economists, mainstream economics aren't even thinking about how to address the growth, right? And we did an episode on regenerative economics. there's a few people trying to see if we can come up with some sort of circular economy, something, but like, the vast majority of economists, they don't even attempt to address what happens like at the end of that curve. I mean, there is no end, but like, where are we going? Like, there's not even the slightest attempt. Politically, even if like we had some great vision for how to coordinate on these issues, you know, between all these nations, do you think like anyone's going to be okay with taking a hit on their gas prices or their grocery bills? Like the level of obstacles to overcome.
And I think we're also just talking about it at like the scale of our own country, right? Like, even if we had some sort of massive shift in politics and in thought in the United States, where like, let's say even in the US, if people became okay with like, yeah, I'll pay higher prices for gases so that we can, you know, invest into cleaner energy or something like that. That doesn't mean that the population of, let's say, India is going to be willing to make those kind of sacrifices. And I think it goes back to kind of the zero-sum, like, economic arms races and prisoners dilemmas we face across the world, where even if we do change the way we function and think as a country, you have an entire spectrum of nations that have either been stepped on historically, trying to get their own economies to the scale of the United States, where, okay, fine, like, the United States agrees that we need to change the way we do things, but how in good faith can we ask nations that we have actively sabotaged to do the same, right?
It's interesting because clearly you would need new institutions, new systems to govern like world order in some capacity to create a more level playing field on these things. Like, countries with certain abundances should share with others, and like, that's not going to happen voluntarily. You have to create some sort of new incentive structure, right, to change the game theory. We did an episode on that. That's you know, very very interesting to think about. I think in practice, yeah, there's a lot of issues with it. But what's interesting to me is the neoliberal paradigm, the globalization, the free markets, free trade, all this shit has created a sort of interdependence that is actually a good basis for like cooperation, right? If you're interdependent with these other nations, then you have, you know, each nation has something to leverage to start to maybe hopefully build something that could create a, I don't know, some sort of more balanced, equal kind of distribution of resources, potentially.
The problem is that this economic system was organized on exploitation and domination by a few countries and a few social classes within the country.
Yes.
Where even if it's functioning at its peak capacity, this economic model still, ultimately speaking, will screw over a percentage of your society. And we're seeing it, you know, in Europe, for instance, where you have kind of the European Union neoliberal economic order, but it's gutted the industrial bases of smaller countries like Romania, leaving their population basically destitute. And you have waves and waves of migration leaving certain countries to others because this kind of neoliberal system creates an inherent system of imbalance that favors some countries over others. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Radius of Reason. Just a reminder, if you want to support our platform, be sure to subscribe.
And of course, leave a comment. Let us know what you think. Well, I think, you know, I think it's interesting. Like, is it possible for these, you know, more developed nations to live the kind of lifestyles they do if they didn't have millions of people, you know, under slave labor, basically producing their products and like basically subsidizing kind of that luxury?
Well, I mean, let's
like, if everyone was living kind of at, well, first of all, there's not enough resources on the planet for everyone to live like we do in, you know, in Germany or the US or whatever. But even if there were, like, you know, how does that actually balance out? Like, can you have that luxury, or are robots going to, you know, replace the slave labor workforce? You know, like, what's going to happen there? That's, to me, that would be interesting if someone ran the numbers on that to see how much of an imbalance there is.
Even if the robots came to replace like the shitty working conditions that humans have to work in, you still have to produce those robots and you still have to source the materials for those robots. So even if you create complete like economic harmony, you're still going to be blasting the shit out of the Earth's core to source, you know, precious metals. And that's going to happen somewhere, right? There's going to be some community somewhere that's going to be polluted to shit because we're extracting materials.
Exactly. And you know, it's not just the robots, it's the entire like green transition, right? I mean, there's a really interesting guy named Simon Michaud who's done work on like how many, you know, like how much resources you need for just like one generation of like renewables to replace like fossil fuels. And it's for certain metals, for example, like we're orders of magnitude, like in a deficit on what is needed, you know, versus what's available. And it's just like, just run the numbers, you know, don't just assume like, oh, we'll have solar panels, wind, whatever, we'll figure it out. Don't assume nuclear is going to be good enough because it's a different kind of energy, right? There's this issue of energy fungibility. Like it doesn't, like not everything translates well. You need new infrastructure. Like you said, that requires further mining resources. It takes time. And in the meantime, we're continuing to pump CO2 into the atmosphere. If we double the concentration, we're around 400 parts per million now. If we double it, which is estimated we might by the end of the century, they said cognitive ability declines by 21% at that point. So we're going to be dumber. We're going to be less capable of like solving these greatest problems because of literally the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's not just warming the planet. It's actually making us dumber. By the way, I recommend people get a CO2 monitor at home and see what happens when you don't open your windows. It's not like I mean, mine right now, I can kind of see it. It's like 800 parts per million. So I'm functioning at least, you know, close to 20% under what I would otherwise be functioning at. So that, hopefully that's my excuse for today. But there was a point we made about kind of how neoliberalism has you know, its foundational basis is almost like exploitation. And I've been reading about it as well. And that seems to be the case, is that a lot of the elites in the Western countries would exploit other countries. You know, when they had some sort of issue, they would come in and say, hey, we'll bail you out, the IMF or whatever, bail you out. But you need to, you know, do all these things that, you know, contribute to globalization.
I've always been reading The Shock Doctrine.
Not quite, but there's another book, but same idea.
Yeah.
And it's like super fucked up. So people should go read about the history of neoliberalism and what it's done to these other economies and how much it's benefited the elite class.
Well, but maybe let's take it. It's benefited the elite class. Yes, absolutely. But has it also benefited places like the United States? I mean, do you think the quality of life, which, you know, we can agree that, yeah, there's obviously problems in quality of life in the US, and the quality of life has rapidly dipped since 2008. But for the sake of this conversation, we can probably agree that there is a certain quality of life in the US that is higher than other parts of the world, hence why people still try to move to this country in large droves. Do you think this higher quality of life in the United States would be possible without these sorts of things, without shock capitalism, without kind of this injection of neoliberal economic theory into the countries that we quote unquote assist?
Maybe not at the scale of population that we have, because all of those things are interdependent, right? I think you could have a high quality of life without, you know, succumbing to like just a crazy amount of globalization and complete deregulation of markets and everything. I think it's possible, but yeah, we've definitely benefited. I mean, again, we have millions and millions of people working as slaves to basically subsidize our standard of living. I mean, every laptop and phone is using, you know, cobalt from the Congo, and that's millions of people working in mines there as basically slaves, getting paid like 80 cents a week.
I mean, the fact that we're able to record this remotely, talk to each other, I mean, how many other human lives had to be ground to dust to enable this?
Yeah, it's insanely fucked up. And I understand why people don't want to look into it. And like, I mean, I'll be totally honest, like, this past year, I mean, this shit has definitely affected me mentally. Like, just reading about everything, reading about how much fucked up shit is actually going on. Worse than you think. Everyone knows in the background there's some fucked up shit, right? Everyone knows, like, okay, there's this climate change thing. Well, not everyone. Some people are still fucking in denial. But even people that are, like, relatively reasonable, knowledgeable, they know some of this shit is going on, but it's extremely unpleasant to be constantly thinking about these things. And I have for the podcast, but also out of my own curiosity. I'm not doing it because it makes me feel better, you know, but it is important to know these things. And it's like, it is like we said at the beginning, it's worse than people think.
What do we do with that knowledge though? I mean, I think there is also like the burden of knowing. Does it change? I mean, okay, there's like a spectrum, right? Like, you could either go and join like an Amish community and absolve yourself of a lot of the immediate consequences of individual consumerism. But
I think, see, here's the problem, man. You kind of have to play the game to change the game with the way things are set. If you become Amish, if you go full Unabomber, well, I mean, actually, Unabomber, maybe like that. Given what happened to the United Healthcare CEO, maybe like vigilante justice or some attempt at messaging through more extreme measures is like, maybe that is more effective these days. I don't know. Given how viral content can go in the online media space. But no, I mean, I think if you try to opt out and you say, I'm going to go live in the forest, or I'm going to go become a Luddite. You're okay. Like, you've done something. Maybe you feel better. but the people that are more power hungry are going to continue to stay in positions of power, gain positions of power, and they're going to be steering the ship towards further disaster, right? They're going to be steering this Titanic towards the iceberg. And then it's just, that's just what it is. If all the people that wanted to go live in the forest and become Amish and all this shit, that's another problem. But it's like, if all of them decided I'm going to gain the most power and then try to do the ethical thing, which of course that also begs the question of like, do I have to do unethical things to gain the power? And then once I've gotten the power, has it corrupted me? Okay. Different set of questions, but from a standpoint of like, what are the type of people that tend to gravitate towards power and what are the type of people that don't? If all the people that naturally are not predisposed to gain power, but in theory had some talents, like maybe they still had some charisma or whatever that could allow them to gain power, if they decided to gain power through, let's say, education or some sort of cultural incentive or norm, a new cultural norm or something, and the people that naturally are predisposed to gain power were, you know, unable to do so, like we would see a very different world, I think, because I think there is something to be said about the natural predispositions that people have. In terms of how they would maybe use their power. I don't know. I mean, it's a very complicated issue, obviously. There's a lot of different factors. But
unfortunately, we have a lot of examples of how those things turn out, where almost every like successful revolutionary movement that we've seen in human history, inevitably, it brings about change to a certain extent. But all that ends up happening is just a replication of the former power structure, where it just becomes the same tool, like oppressive system that it just shuffles out individuals like within a hierarchy and within a bureaucracy. And it, you know, changes the, you know, roles that occupy positions of power. But ultimately speaking, it kind of has the same effect on society. Maybe massive revolutionary upheavals bring about slight moments of incremental change that kind of add up over like a course of time. But I think that there's probably something in like the human condition that attracts us first of all to power. And then there's something in the human condition that influences the way that we wield power that becomes almost common across the board, independent of what political ideology or economic belief system you fall under. Ultimately speaking, I think at the core, most people want to live a good quality of life. And I think that always ends up turning into like certain maybe signifiers of what a good quality of life is. And
yeah,
even if we overthrow, let's say hypothetically, this entire economic system and institute something brand new, I think we're probably just going to get caught in the same traps, ultimately speaking.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's why you need to design better systems. Like, I think there is, I mean, the US has its problems, but you know, the idea of having, you know, the separation of powers and everything, like it's a step up from like previous systems, right? And it's worked well in certain respects. And maybe now it's kind of decaying and, you know, you have multinational corporations that are extremely influential. And I don't think the founding fathers like predicted that, but okay. Like now we kind of see what's going on. If you were to redesign, you know, political institutions and economic systems and whatnot, I think we could do a better job. And I think it's about mitigating like the worst instincts of humanity, right? And it's true that there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. I forget who said that, but that's a fucking amazing quote. And it's like, we're not going to design a perfect system. Human nature is always going to try to find a way to corrupt things. But can we design better systems? And there's no way anyone can fucking tell me we've designed like the best systems possible. Like if you just start with that premise, it's like, is this the best that humanity can do? I can't. I don't fucking believe it.
What if the shocking acknowledgement has to be that, yes, in fact, this is the best we can do? but also, I mean, the fact that, like, I don't know if we fully appreciate that the current system we have in the United States, politically and economically, has only been allowed to exist because of a few chance factors. Geography being the first, right? That the United States has been able to flourish, grow, evolve so rapidly and so successfully because we're geographically isolated from the majority of the flashpoints around the world, where the major things that decimated the global economy in the past 200 years or so, the U.S. has been largely isolated from it. The two world wars being kind of the first things, right? Where Western Europe was completely devastated and gutted, the United States wasn't. And it was allowed to kind of step in as the industrial powerhouse because none of its infrastructure was destroyed in the 20th century. The same thing with, like, I guess, like, global trends in colonialism. Like, the United States was colonized. Those same colonizers kind of eventually created their own zone of influence. They, you know, massacred native populations, but then they kind of essentially established themselves, and we did not have to face the levels of exploitation that South America and Sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia faced too. And those are just complete, like, random ass factors that contributed to the fact that the U.S. is where it's at today. And I don't know if that could be recreated or replicated anywhere else, because no other country has really had the benefit of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of luck involved in that. I guess, do we want to recreate it, though? Like,
valid question.
Like, what has it led to, right?
Well, it's okay. Look, at the face value, it's led to a situation where you and I can have this conversation over a certain, like, technological medium without.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like that framing. I think, like, you got to zoom out. You know, it's true. Like, it's okay. It's nice, but it's like, if it leads to fucking tremendous environmental devastation and fucking runaway effects with the climate and nuclear war and shit, like, if the things that have arisen from, you know, the fortuitous events that led to the U.S. and its power dominance and everything, like, if that's the end result, like, it's not a good thing. And I mean, it's, you know, going back to what I said, I think the big problem here is now the inertia of this global economic system based on growth is just, it's so great. It's hard to imagine what can be possible, like, what could possibly be done to avert course. Avert course, is that, did I just
divert course?
Divert course.
It's all good. You got some carbon in your apartment, you know. Carbon,
yeah, dioxide. It's. I think it's a good 1200 now. Oh, so wish me luck. But yeah, I don't know what you do with the force of this economic incentives that exist. It's just so great. And I don't know. It's. Yeah, it just kind of fucking sucks, man. It's that, to me, that's the most, like, depressing thing about the meta crisis is that this is such a fundamental piece that needs, like, changing. And it's the one that I fail to see how you change it without causing some amount of at least short-term harm, like legitimate short-term harm, that then would create the impression for the greater population that, okay, like, we don't want to do the things, like, we don't want to do the things that are required to really, like, change direction here. We're going to head towards, like, we'd rather be blind and oblivious to the collapse, which will short itself out, right? Like, we will reach these planetary boundaries. There will be instability as a result, and there will be some level of collapse. And then, you know, for, you know, God forbid there's, you know, some sort of insane nuclear war, there will be a rebuilding phase. And to me, like, that's the important piece here, is like, use this time of relative stability to try to find, like, good ideas that can be useful when we start to rebuild. Because I think it seems to me almost inevitable that there will be some amount of collapse.
I think that when you look at some of these prescriptions and you kind of look at the realities of what the current global economic system is hurtling towards, one of the only things you can have is really revolutionary optimism. And maybe that's not what Mariana would call it, but I think to a certain extent, it's what she inevitably described, this idea that, hey, humanity has faced down very, very challenging circumstances in the past, and we have found a way out. We found a solution. And I think it's easy. And this is something I've noticed.
I mean, we haven't, though, right? Like, we haven't, because at the scale of certain, like, nations that have failed, like, there have been horrific things that have happened, right?
That's true.
Like, collapse of civilizations is the norm.
It is.
Right? And so,
I think.
Yeah, and then rebuilding. But now, I think, again, the problem with the meta crisis, from the meta crisis standpoint, is now you've got exponential technology, right? You've got the nuclear weapons. You potentially have some fucking super AI surveillance state that's now more feasible than ever.
You know, can't even catch
not yet.
Assassin of a
not yet, but maybe, you know, if this happened in like 10 years from now, maybe he gets caught within minutes.
Agentic AI is kind of becoming more and more of a thing, right? Like, you already have like a certain percentage of, well, I mean, there's a lot of tech companies that are doing research into this, and they're trying to bring about a level of decision-making agency to large language models, which you already have certain companies involved in the defense sector that are piloting like kill algorithms for drones, right? That like an attack drone will be able to fly over an area, identify somebody, and then like without human involvement, make the decision to kill. That's not like a far off like Blade Runner sci-fi thing. That's probably going to happen in the next 5 years.
I mean, I've seen videos of it. I forget the name of the company that's making them, but I've seen their promotional videos.
Yes,
it's pretty fucking terrifying, actually.
Well, I mean, like, it's always set to like, you know, dramatic ass like techno music or some shit.
True.
Yeah, the kind of cinematics. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah,
I think
they got me.
Yeah, they got you. Yeah, they're now a sponsor of the show. I think that you have to have. I've noticed both in the comment sections for our platform, you know, in other discussions online, like, I think meta crisis type discussions can always descend and often do descend into like absolute doomerism. And I think that isn't really just like blind idealism and optimism isn't productive. I think doomerism and kind of wallowing in the reality of things isn't really productive. And unfortunately, when you have a prism for looking at the world that does elevate some of the greatest challenges, and it does tend to dive deep into like the compounding existential threats we face, it's so easy just to fall into this kind of perpetual gloom about what's happening. And I find myself kind of slipping into that too, right? Where the more you look at these problems and the more you think about these problems, well, the more bleak things do seem, right? And I think you have to have almost an irrational faith in yourself to navigate these things, and faith in maybe our civilization. And it isn't like a calculated or like a pragmatic response to things, but I think really that's the only prescription that you can really carry through all of this. While we're, you know, searching for solutions and trying to find solutions, you just have to have a mindset that doesn't allow you to slip into just rampant doomerism.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. I think Yeah, it's important to think about these things. It's important to be aware of them, but you still have to live your life. Like, you're useless if you're not in the right state of mind. If you're not at least meeting some like minimum threshold of like, I don't know, just living like enjoying some of the, you know, amazing aspects of life, like, then, you know, what's the point of saving anything? Like, you got to enjoy it a little bit, and you shouldn't feel guilty, you know? Like, I mean, my car consumes gasoline, you know, no matter how much I try to avoid plastic. Like, I mean, there's a lot of plastic in my house. I see a lot of plastic right now as I'm looking around. Like, what are you going to do? And so I think you have to be realistic, but yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's important to have these conversations with people that you otherwise may not feel like you need to. I think it's important to just try to make discussions about the meta crisis a little bit more, commonplace, I would say. Let it like permeate the ether of culture a little bit more. And, you know, it's, you know, sometimes it just takes one genius to like really change things, right? In human history. I mean, how much of human history is, you know, we've reached these points where like a single individual has really changed the course of history. I mean, Genghis Khan, like Einstein, Newton. I mean, you got some very, very important figures. And the more a certain kind of idea is permeating a certain culture, it just makes it more likely that maybe someone with the right kind of ethics and intelligence can maybe come up with something that, like, and I think that's the thing. Like, it seems like we're heading towards collapse, but there's always like black swan events, right? There's always like certain game-changing moments. And it is kind of hard to imagine right now, like, what that would be. Would it be some sort of new energy source? I think that would be obviously huge, right? Like, you get off fossil fuels. We find this new energy source that somehow we can use the existing infrastructure and it doesn't have any like negative externalities, right? Like, it doesn't have any emissions or anything that lead to some sort of environmental catastrophe.
Hopium.
Like if you were to, I'm just saying, like, but it's like magic, right? I mean, I'm basically saying, if could there be a magical energy source? And like, it does seem like we live in that sort of universe. But you never know. I mean, I think we're at that point where it would take something on the level of almost magic to get us out. Without some kind of collapse scenario. That's what I think is going to happen. Whether that's in the next 20, 30 years or the next 100 years, I don't know. But I think, I mean, would you say things are trending for the better or worse based on what you know?
I was trying to kind of take stock of things, like, and looking really back at like what 2024 brought about for maybe our human experience, collectively speaking. I don't know what the answer to that is. I think it is interesting that the bulletin of atomic scientists hasn't increased their, well, they also haven't decreased it, but their doomsday prediction. Like, the doomsday clock hasn't advanced. It's been at 90 seconds to doomsday since, like, let me see real quick. Since 2023. 90 seconds to midnight.
Okay.
You know, they update this pretty regularly, taking into account like various global events, not just like nuclear proliferation, but like they started adding like deployment of AI into their calculations. Maybe they just are a little bit late in changing it, you know, and, you know, the events of the past week, not just with what's happening in Ukraine, but you know, you have rapid escalation in Syria. Like, maybe that's going to change their calculations. Who knows? Do I think things are getting better? No, I don't. But I do think that it's a lot easier to talk about certain things with more people. Then I think there is a greater sense of, and maybe a greater awareness of a, like the economic imbalances. And for as much as this past election in the United States, actually, I don't know if I can even call it divisive, seeing how bad like the Democrats lost. But I think on a lot of issues, I at least have been finding a lot of common ground with people that maybe tend to vote in opposite directions from me. And I think that is promising, maybe in my own kind of localized experience, where talking about class is now a lot easier. And maybe this is like prescriptive of this kind of collapse scenario you're describing. Maybe the closer we get to like a complete economic meltdown, the easier it's going to be to like talk about these things openly. I think that more and more people are aware of the exploitation they face, and more people are realizing that it's not just maybe your little political bloc that thinks about these things. Again, I don't want to keep on bringing up the killing of that CEO in New York this week, but I think the reactions to that are really interesting, because I don't know if society is as divided as we were really like described or we were really like told to by the media during the course of the election. I think people, generally speaking, are aligned on certain factors. I think that is promising. Who knew that like one guy could give so many people so much hope? I don't know. But in terms of like the greater movements and shifts that we describe as the meta crisis, no, I don't think things are getting better. I think, you know, we talked about climate change at the start of the show. You know, we talked about the fact that markedly it's a lot hotter on record this year than in like ever. I don't think we're getting to a place geopolitically, you know, thinking back to our conversation with Mark last episode, I don't think we're at a place where we're resolving any of the global tensions. And, you know, certainly over the past month, the situation with the war in Ukraine has escalated, and you know, now we're launching. Now Russia has kind of been put in a position where they're launching maybe a toned down version of an intercontinental ballistic missile. That doesn't bode well. Certainly, we're not seeing any form of regulation coming through for artificial intelligence, and these deployments are just happening at scale, and more you're kind of witnessing people losing their jobs because of automation. You're seeing AI kind of suck in vast amounts of data, vast amounts of our data, more and more data breaches happening. God knows where that's going. So no, I don't know if on a grand scale, things are getting better, but maybe on an individual level, there are some advances that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it's non-linear. Like certain things, like let's take the internet and social media, for example. You're right. I mean, it allows for the virality of like anything. Like things can change overnight, right? Seemingly. Like it allows for more rapid shifts in culture and awareness of certain things. So that's a pro when, you know, you have these urgent crises, right? So from that standpoint, like that's a potential improvement, but then it's like social media is mostly hijacked at this point by just outrage and fear mongering. And I mean, there's no, like, there's no attempt to fix this. there's literally no, like, who's doing it? Like, It's just like the tech companies are completely just, it's like wild west, you know?
Well, I mean, at least right now on like a policy level, the FTC has been doing a lot to curb the impulses of tech, and especially like, you know.
Well, I mean, in terms of the algorithms though, right? What are the algorithms promoting? They're still, you know, at the core, they're promoting things that maximize the ad revenue.
And I think at that point, it has to come down to like an individual, like in as much as I think there should be restrictions and policy governing these things, I don't know if we're going to get it. Certainly not under the Trump administration, given how, you know,
of course not.
Seems to be empowered in terms of his current cabinet picks. But I do think it comes down to an individual level. And I think it comes down to this is like, okay, all right, let me briefly maybe throw a bone to some of the more like conservative narratives that we see out there. But I think something that I don't know if I would agree with, but that I would acknowledge is probably a far more useful approach is to kind of take care of your immediate circle with regards to those things, right? Like if we're talking about families, right, there is a level of responsibility that parents face in making sure their children either aren't exposed to these algorithms or are actively involved in the stuff that their younger generations consume. This is also it is happening at a policy level globally, because I think Australia just put in a ban for social media access that you have to be like 13, maybe 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it actually.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, if they did that in Australia, good. I think the US should definitely do something.
This is it was reported last week. So Australia passes the world's first social media ban for under 16 year olds.
Okay.
And I mean, that's not like a inconsequential market. Australia is quite a large country with quite a large pool of technology users. Granted, you know, kids are always going to find a way to do this. Like, you know, you can't drink alcohol until you're 21, but how many people start drinking before that? Like, I don't know if it's actually going to like make like that big of a shift, but at least it's being recognized. But back to my point is that I do think it does, in the United States, it does come down to vigilance from an individual level.
You know, I think we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, but
I mean, look, you have I'm not advocating for like the total libertarian side of things. In fact, I do agree that the state, as I've said in multiple episodes before, the state needs to be reformed to an extent where it does actually govern in the interests of, I'd say, people. And that also means having adequate checks put on tech companies and the amount of bullshit they're able to like serve us. And I think that has to happen, but that isn't going to happen tomorrow. That's not going to happen without active involvement. And I think active involvement does come into this maybe more like quote unquote libertarian view of taking accountability for yourself and your immediate surroundings. Like, look, we, at the early days of our show, we spent so much time consuming Andrew Tate content.
Hold on, for the record, to criticize him, not to actually get advice from him.
Right, correct. Yeah, for the record, to criticize, like, yeah, absolutely. To the point where, dude, like, you know, they did like the Spotify rap, this past week. I don't know if you use Spotify or not. One of my top podcasts this year was a fucking like a Andrew Tate RSS feed. It's embarrassing.
That sounds like a you problem.
Sounds like a you problem. I fucking like, dude, like, no, I'm not trying to defend the guy. The one silver lining he talks about, which is like the silver lining that every like right-wing grifter talks about, is individual accountability. And I think that is something every single ideology kind of promotes, is that all you, like, I mean, what is basic therapy? What is basic cognitive behavioral therapy prescribe? That you are only able to control your own environment. What is basic like stoicism argue for, right? You only have control over yourself. And I think that that's the first step in bringing about any like true change, that the only way we're going to drive systemic reform, be it politically or economically, is to get sleep, hydrate, right? You know, maybe spend less time on social media, and then ensure that the people you love and care about have similar opportunities to do so. And then we can go fucking, you know, start the revolution. I'm telling you, man, like that United Healthcare assassin, like that homie was probably hydrated. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, he was well hydrated. He's still hydrating.
He's out there drinking water.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and no one can disagree with that. I mean, that's all necessary. But I think people do need direction and a vision, right? For like, okay, like I've done all these things. The system is still like fucked. And like, what am I going to do? Am I go protesting? Like, I don't know. I don't think protesting is that effective.
I think it is. I think protesting does remind...
What is all the climate activism and environmental protests? What have they done? Almost nothing. Pretty much nothing.
I don't know how to answer that question because I don't know if I have enough information on it. Maybe they have... I mean, they have influenced some things, right? Like...
They've brought a little more attention to the issue. Okay. They've done, maybe they have done a little, but in the grand scheme of things, they haven't stopped.
But
they
haven't. That's not because they're not effective. It's because they're up against, like, if anything, there needs to be more protest because you're up against like the cold, hard reality of like, you know, big oil versus Greta Thunberg. Like, I don't know. Like who's going to win in that like matchup?
So, I mean, what are you suggesting that we should organize more protests? And if someone's like, hey, I'm fucking passionate about these environmental issues, for example, then I should get group my friends together, put out some flyers and say, hey, we're going to fucking protest.
I think it's better than sitting online. I think it is far more productive than just sitting consuming content, said the content creator. but I think... I mean,
look, we have a special mission.
But let's dive into that. Even if it doesn't bring about any change, how is getting your friends together and putting some flyers out anywhere as counterproductive as just sitting in your apartment being upset about it?
I mean, you're comparing to the wrong thing. You should be comparing to what is a more effective action that they could take. Right. And if the effective action is, hey, I'm going to try to get a degree in environmental law and then try to go infiltrate this institution to make like a more direct difference, then I think maybe it is extremely counterproductive to protest instead of doing that thing. I'm not saying that is the thing, but maybe it is. I mean, our last guest, Mark Kukas, that's what he thought. He thought, you know, hey, basically, go to these institutions and change them from within, you know?
Right. But also getting access to those institutions is Mark, like, you know, to get, you know, the proverbial degree in environmental law, like that's a huge hurdle you have to clear, right? Because you have to be able to afford to get a degree in environmental law first. Costs almost nothing aside from a couple bucks of like copies you got to make to throw some posters up.
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, everyone has different talents and, you know, luxuries or whatever, privileges. And, you know, if you have the ability to gain a certain education or a skill that can allow you to more directly contribute to some of these issues from an institutional standpoint, from like an engineering standpoint, if you're talking about like, let's say, renewable energy, I don't know, if you're a fucking nerd, right? And you like, you think you can invent some shit, like, yeah, go in that direction, right? There is no one size fits all answer here, right? Because there's a huge variance in people's interests and abilities. So do the thing that you're interested in and also good at that contribute to the meta crisis, right? Or contribute to potential solutions to the meta crisis. It's like, you don't have to do anything to contribute to the meta crisis. This is a default fucking mode.
The basilisk theory. The meta crisis is just Rocco's basilisk. It's just kind of the inevitable that we have to
enlighten people who don't know what that is.
I can't do that because if I enlighten them about it, then I'm going to curse them for all eternity.
Okay. Well, that's a good point. Yeah. That's a fair point.
What I'm saying is, in fact, we're serving the meta crisis. Like we are actually we're saying we're a meta crisis podcast. We're actually trying to bring about the meta crisis.
I don't know about that. Maybe you are.
Maybe, on an individual level, you know, talk about like productivity, like what is productive, what is more productive than ending the world?
Well, I mean, I think it actually, you know, it's funny though, it does highlight the complexity and the unpredictability of things, you know, like there's a butterfly effect here. It's like, what if this episode you know, I'm not saying it's going to get a lot of views, but like, what if the one guy that was going to like solve the meta crisis listens to this and he's like, you know what? There's no hope for humanity. After listening to this, I'm just going to fucking sit on the couch and play video games. Then we may have, yeah, really, we have, we may become the biggest contributor to the meta crisis from that standpoint. So, yeah. So, I mean, it's, there's a butterfly effect thing, and there's, it's what really makes this so complicated, because the reason we're in this position in the first place is because our way of solving problems has led to this, these greater problems, right? We think we've been making all this progress, but it's actually led to bigger and bigger problems, right? It's like pushed the problem down the road, and it's like, oh, it's better in the short term. And then we realize there's a problem, and then we try to fix it, and we're like, oh, we sort of fixed it. But then actually it pushed the problem back again, but the problem's growing each time. And then eventually you hit the planetary boundaries of like, oh, you can't keep growing the problem. You can't keep having, like, there's nothing beyond destroying the Earth's capacity to regenerate itself, right?
Like, I mean, that's, like, what is the cadence of, like, humanity's march to the future? Like, what are we heading towards anyways? Is that just, like, the inevitable outcome of anything? I think
I don't think it has to be, though. Why would it be inevitable? I mean,
I think at some point we defined our maybe species by forward moving evolution, right? Like, for whatever, I mean, it's been accelerated very much so, but our trajectory has always been forward. There's never been a moment in the human experience where when we're just like chilling. Maybe there has, I don't know. In the prehistorical times, but everything is always like, it's momentum forward. It's always like a drive. And I think that defines our species to a certain extent, that we're always, I mean, I think that's the inevitable conclusion. Maybe we're heading towards that. Like, we're going to have to eventually leave the bounds of our planet for one reason or another, but because
you're starting to sound like Elon, bro.
Yeah, no. All right, then let's put a break on that.
I mean, I think the point here is we need to be a little bit smarter and more cautious about how we solve problems, and also what problems we choose to solve. Because, I mean, we had an evolutionary anthropologist on a couple of episodes ago, and he's saying, and other research has said, that these modern hunter-gatherers, and probably some of the prehistoric ones as well, are actually like happier than people in the developed world. Like, wait a minute, that should be a fucking red flag right there.
But we can't go, like, back to that, you know.
No, I understand, but like the point there is, something's gone wrong that's the case, because we have made all this progress. We have all this technology, and there, of course, are things that we don't want to lose. We don't want, I'm going to have shoulder surgery in like a week. I want like anesthesia, right? I want antibiotics.
You know, you should really go with your primal ancestors and just like wave. Like, no. Like, just carve it out.
Just fucking get a machete and just do cut it. This thing off.
Lop it off.
So, like, there's things we definitely have made progress on. We don't want to take back. We don't want to lose. But the things that are most important, it seems like maybe we've compromised on it in ways that we haven't realized, right? The social fabric of life is completely different. Can urban planning evolve to address that? But
urban planning has already evolved multiple times to address various excesses and factors. I mean, the fact that the notion of a public park, right? We both live in cities that have very large parks, plenty of green space to occupy. That's not like an accident. That required consideration from an urban planning standpoint that, oh, wait, no, we need like designated green spaces within our cities. Right. The concept of like space between buildings, granted, you know, now that might be changing in terms of how real estate development is happening. But New York City had very, very, I'd say, crammed housing, crammed living conditions, where buildings were stacked on top of each other, created really unsanitary conditions. So then after Chicago burned down, the Great Chicago Fire, all of a sudden you rebuilt the city, but you can kind of start spacing them out a bit. Hence, Chicago has a lot of alleyways, has a lot of places to, you know, keep trash dispensers, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So urban planning evolves in tandem with correcting certain excesses or correcting certain mishaps. To the same thing, you know, everybody's talking about we need like third spaces or whatnot. I think that's a totally reasonable thing that's going to happen like in the next like 20, 30 years. We're like the next wave of like thought over how we design cities and communities. It's going to take into account that we need these sorts of like neutral cultural spaces. Now,
yeah, I guess
we might have an economic system right now that is restricting that sort of like adaptive planning, right? That maybe these sorts of adjustments to how we design living spaces was only possible because we had a certain economic system that wasn't entirely captured by profit seeking and corporate interests.
Well, I think that's the thing. Like the current drivers of our culture and everything, like the incentives are not aligned with our well-being, right? And there will be some evolution. Like, I'm not denying that culture evolves, that urban planning as a field is going to evolve, and there's going to be new ideas, and there's going to be certain positives that arise from that. But when you zoom out, you have to change, like, the big incentives, I think. That's the goal. Otherwise, you just generate more problems. Right. Okay, it's just whack-a-mole, right? If you don't address the systemic incentives, then okay, you're just patching, like you're putting a patch on the problem, because there are new problems will emerge. So how do we change that? I think that's the biggest thing that the meta crisis and systems thinking really teaches us, is look at the wider system and notice that, okay, this is what it is preferring. What is the goal? Like, so you have to ask yourself, like, what's the fucking goal of our current system? Just growth. It's just to make money. Like, it's just to increase profits and make more money. That is the overriding goal. So everything else takes a backseat, and that's why you're going to only have shitty little patchy solutions to some of these problems. Now, if things get bad enough, then yeah, you know, those are maybe the opportunities for bigger systemic changes. But then I think you have to consider the time frame here, right? If things are as urgent as they seem, or might be indicated by, let's say, activists and scientists, for example, climate change, then you don't have, like, waiting for things to collapse isn't, you know, that's not even the opportunity at this point. Like, if we reach a point of like a collapse civilizational state, and when I say collapse, I mean, I'm using that term vaguely on purpose, because it may just be, you know, a less globalized world with a few more resource wars, but there's still some, you know, a little bit more inequality, but you still have antibiotics, you still have, you know, you still got your TVs running and your computers, but like things are just in kind of like a very depressed state. That's like one possibility. Of course, you have more extreme examples of what could happen.
What if they've already collapsed? Like, what if we're already living through the collapse?
We might be. I mean, some people might say that. I think this is as bad as it gets.
Yeah. I mean, objectively speaking, like it's not fantastic.
I don't think this is as bad as it gets.
I think Mariana, on her second episode with us, really pointed it out, is that at the end of the day, we're a bunch of like middle class folks sitting around talking on a podcast. But outside of this, the world is, for a lot of people, very, very challenging. And I think...
But it can be far more challenging. And there can be a lot more suffering.
But it could be far more challenging. But I really think shit is really bad for like the minimum wage earners in this country. Very, very
bad. Oh, yeah.
I'm sure it is. Very bad for migrants right now. You know, migrants that aren't coming over with like, you know, PhDs from you know, European research institutions or PhDs from, I guess, African research institutions. Like working class people have it very, very bad. And I think the reason the meta crisis is taking off as like a concept and people are starting to think and talk about it is because we're introducing the possibility that it could also start impacting people that are living comfortably. But in reality, shit has been tough and shit has been bad for the majority of people on this planet for a very long time. And I would be curious to pose the question of, do they feel like a collapse is imminent, or are they living through whatever collapse we're predicting for ourselves?
I think they are, from the way that I look at it, I think, you know, people that are enduring financial hardship are living through they're not living through the kind of collapse that I'm thinking of in my head. I mean, to them, it doesn't matter, of course. Like, they're enduring hardship.
Yeah.
They're struggling. Like, it doesn't matter what label you put on it. But I like to think about it at collapse, especially the more like extreme forms, as a breakdown of certain societal norms due to scarcity of, let's say, resources, energy, like much greater levels of unemployment and like just societal political instability.
I think those are all anxieties that impact white collar middle class people. I think that maybe is my realization. And the more we've talked about
it, what do you mean?
I think that for somebody trapped in the cycle of poverty, to them, all those things are already a reality. I think that the anxieties that surround things that Daniel Schmachtenberger talks to when he talks to audiences, those are the anxieties of middle to upper class people fearing they're going to have to fall to the level of those trapped in the poverty cycle in the United States and globally. Because I think for them, it is already happening and it has been happening. And I think I think platforms such as ours are speaking to the anxieties of a certain class. And in America, in the United States, let me clarify, there is a very real anxiety of falling below your own status. And I think that's why there's a resentment for, let's say, homeless people, and why it causes so much panic when people see homeless encampments for within their communities, because it reminds them that they can still go lower. And I think that's what a lot of these topics are kind of, why they're catching on, is because it's reminders that those within our social class, and I think we need to acknowledge also that we are part of a certain social class at this point, we're facing these existential risks in the way that we do because the prescription that those risks offer us is that we are going to fall to that level. Is that we're going to lose our stability, lose our comfort, lose our access to electricity, internet, heating, cooling, whatnot. But for a very large percentage of our planet, that is already the case. I think that, to me, is my realization.
I'm not sure how to even address this. I think there's some truth in what you're saying, but I think it's a bit misguided, because I think, again, this is my interpretation of the meta crisis and collapse. But I mean, I think we're talking about, we're looking at it from a civilizational standpoint. And the truth is that, like, you know, what is the poverty level in the US, for example?
I mean, I guess we have to define poverty, right?
I mean, is it under people making under like 20K, 15K a year? Or like, what is, I'm not actually sure what it is, but I don't look at it from like an individual standpoint, I guess, is maybe the bigger point that I want to make. I look at it from a breakdown of breakdown of the certain kinds of, let's say, coordination that we take for granted, for example. Like we take international trade as a given, but under a collapse scenario, that may not be the case. How does that impact, you know, someone's supply of fucking life-saving medicine? How does that impact jobs at a much larger, like, it's just a much, much larger scale of issue, right? Like, but
let me ask this question. If you are right now a 13-year-old in Gaza, what the fuck does it matter that global supply chains will collapse? Right.
You can point to people that are living like horrible circumstances. That's always been true, right? There's kids mining cobalt ore in the Congo. Again, for 80 cents a week or some shit like that. That shit is terrible. Like, I think if we can solve some of these greater systemic issues, then maybe we wouldn't have those situations. We wouldn't have Gaza. We wouldn't have cobalt mining in the Congo in the same way. But that's not, like, that doesn't change the fact that we have this massive economic system that's fucking going to destroy the entire planet. Like, there's just no stopping this thing, right? It already has destroyed. I mean, wildlife population is down 70% since 1970. By 2050, there's going to be more plastic in the ocean than fish. You know, we love that stat, right? Like, we mentioned that a few episodes ago.
I think there's something like
that's a different issue than, like, we have wars and people have suffered from that. We have real extreme poverty that's fucked up. People go hungry and die. Like, that still happens. We have a lot of bad shit going on. But the point is, it can get significantly worse for the vast majority of the population, and the hopes of, like, addressing those problems for the people that are suffering now, that goes out the window too.
I think so. My position that I think I'm forming is that at the core of it, the reason why people care about these topics now is because we are afraid of our proverbial children being the ones having to work the cobalt mines. I think as a society, we were perfectly okay for the longest time that it's only.
Is that a bad thing?
I don't think it's a bad thing, but I think there is an undercurrent of hypocrisy to it. And I think that's what kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth occasionally, is that. I think for a majority of the world, the meta crisis is already here. It's already happened. It's already, like, all these doomsday predictions that we discuss have all, like, people are already experiencing it.
In a crisis. I mean, it's not that some of the things are like climate change is happening now. Ecological destruction is happening now. Artificial intelligence, like these primitive algorithms that make up social media recommendation engines, they're affecting us now. They're leading to certain people getting elected over others. Like, they're leading us to be addicted to our phones. They're impacting the social fabric and culture. Like, so from that standpoint, I completely agree. Like, the meta crisis is now. It's not like this far off thing, but I think you're being a bit too harsh on people's motivations, especially because I think we didn't always have this information, right? And we weren't always doing this. Like, we weren't always burning fossil fuels and destroying the fucking planet. And people were pointing that out when they did realize it. But now more and more people have access to that information. And more people are realizing, like, wait a minute, my lifestyle is contributing to this thing. And I should be concerned about this. And yeah, the future generations are going to pay a huge, huge fucking price. And yeah, we're dumping toxic chemicals into the fucking environment at an exponential rate. Like, Yeah, I mean, it is affecting us too, and we are concerned about our children and this and that. And like, if you want to call that hypocrisy, because there's people that today are mining the material that goes into our cell phone batteries, like, okay, I mean, call it hypocrisy, but I think it's, I think that's a very like hyper focused and harsh interpretation of what's going on. And the fact of the matter is, the same people that are mining the cobalt and enduring economic hardship would also, most of them would be like most people today. If you reverse the situation, they would just go on about their lives. They would, and the few that would care, you would also call them hypocrites. Right. And like, so like, I mean, it like, okay. I mean, I kind of see what you're saying, but I'm also like, and, you know, like, I mean, like, and like, okay. That's, I mean, that's my two cents on that, but maybe, I don't know.
It's like, if studying the meta crisis doesn't make you a communist, then
I mean, this is another thought I had. I'm glad you brought that up. You think about like oil, right? How is it that we live in this society where someone who just happens to own like a certain piece of land that happens to have oil is now like a fucking trillionaire? Like, you didn't fucking create that oil.
But you have.
What does it mean that this, it took millions of years for that resource to kind of develop and evolve? And it's just like all yours, and we're like okay with that? Like, that's insane. No, it's not all yours. Fuck you. Like, this is, there is a commons, right? That we have to respect, and it's completely unrespected. And yeah, I mean, it opens a whole can of worms about like private property ownership and shit like that, right? Like, what does that lead to? What are the downstream implications of that? Is there a better way we can figure that out? And, you know, of course, people will come in with the communism hasn't worked and this and that, but it's like, there's something wrong with the fact that if you just happen to own this land, and, you know, who knows how you came about owning it, right? Like, did you fucking genocide an entire group of people?
Which, 9 times out of 10, yes.
Right. So it's just like, it's just mind boggling, like how that's the world we live in. It's like, oh, yeah. And people, like, you should be outraged, right?
Why don't we apply the same thing to like oxygen, right? Like, if you walk into my land, you have to pay me. A fee to breathe, to be able to breathe the air that is on my land.
Hey, don't give them any ideas.
I mean, like, isn't that just like the next logical step? Like, okay, why do we apply it to like underground resources? Like, if you are on my property, you must pay me a fee because you're breathing my air.
But it's a great argument. It's, I think the technical philosophical term for what you did is reductio ad absurdum. It's like you used an absurd example of a principle in play. And it's like, yes, that's crazy. But the same thing's happening with oil, right? And so, I mean, that's the, yeah, like 1000%. It's fucking crazy. And then, of course, naturally the question arises, so then what's the alternative? Is it communism, right? Is it? It's some sort of better. It shouldn't be like completely binary. Like, I think there's merits to capitalism. I think there's merits to like competition and the fact that I don't know if everyone should get the same exact thing. I think there are some people that, you know, I think we should maybe reward people that with certain talents more and people that have worked harder. Like, I think that's okay, but
everybody should have the same foundation they start with. I think and I don't know, like, I don't think I'm a communist. I think we've gone down that road. I think our, you know, respective backgrounds, I'm sure our ancestors one generation removed probably had some good and bad things to say about the system. But I don't know if it's like a communist signifier to say that as a foundation, everybody should be covered on the baselines. Everybody should have healthcare. Everybody should have education. We can throw something in about housing there as well. Those 3 points. That's it. Everything else you achieve with that, because what you do with your education, that's on you. You know, if you decide to become a preem like software developer and you create a tool that everybody loves, like, congratulations,
You get to be rewarded for that. And that's where the market force, I think, is a beneficial thing. But I think everybody should have a chance at that kind of opportunity if they want it. And I don't think that should be a radical position to take.
And no one should be able to exploit the commons for just their sheer personal gain.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I think that, yeah.
I like that. You want a good foundation, and I think it's only fair. And if you were to be dropped in any sort of world, like what kind of world would you want to be dropped in, right?
Wouldn't like the most cynical character of a capitalist want to have a pool of potential workers to exploit that are educated and technically sound? Like, I mean, think about the Soviet Union collapsed, right? I was talking to somebody about it the other day. Like, Who was Google founded by? Right. The notion of Google, I mean, there's a bunch of like post-Soviet kind of emigres. And the Soviet Union collapses, and all of a sudden you have a massive influx of like very, very highly educated individuals coming into the Western markets, right? You have engineers, you have scientists, you have geologists, you have writers, all these things. They're coming over into the West, and they're going to work for tech companies, and they're going to work for manufacturing companies. And there's a huge boom in, I think, productive capacity. I don't want to say that like Silicon Valley really took off because the Soviet Union collapsed, but I'm sure it didn't hurt to have an influx of like educated workforce all of a sudden emerging for you to tap into. So like, why wouldn't a billionaire like tech bro want to have the greatest possible access to an educated technical workforce? Doesn't make any sense, right? I guess maybe like they would start questioning things, and like it'd be harder to like force feed people like shitty ass algorithms because you'd have a basis of critical thinking. But like, I just don't understand like how that would even ever be taken as like an anti-capitalist or like a communist argument. To like, yes, we need to invest heavily into education.
And people don't like their tax money being touched, man, or their money being taxed.
But like, we're all already being taxed to shit. Like, we pay a shit ton of taxes. We pay a shit ton of money to like defense.
Yeah, I think that's another thing I've been really like noticing this year is it's the argument is always like more or less of like a thing that exists. It's not like, can we develop a better version of the thing? Like, is it, oh, we need more or less regulation, more or less taxes. Hold on. Can we develop better regulation that isn't necessarily more or less? It's just a different kind of regulation. And if that happens to be a little bit more, if a good regulation takes a, I don't know, larger form, so be it. It probably wouldn't, right? Because there's something to be said about it, simplicity and efficiency and whatnot. But, you know, in general, like, look at how to make a thing better, not to like get rid of it or just have more of it if it's already not very effective, right? Like, just taxing us more and not doing anything with that money. Yeah, I'm fucking against that. It does, like, fuck you. Don't take more of my money. Like, I see how you use it, government. Like, you're fucking shit. You're terrible. I mean, anyone. I'm not going to get into that.
But I mean, that feeds into participating in a political process where if the government is shit, how much of that is a reflection off of us that we're not?
Much of it is also a reflection of corporate interest and the monopolization that is a natural consequence of capitalism? Absolutely. And like, it's just,
but at the same time, we have elected officials into power that have passed legislation that allows for this unchecked corporate influence over politics. That is, like, I 100% agree that this is a consequence of the economic system we have in place, but it does. And I can't, like, maybe like that 15 minute Ben Shapiro clip I watched today is like just warped my mind, because I do think we have to also accept that we have agency and we are allowing ourselves to become distracted. And I think vigilance is the most important thing you can have as a human being.
Okay. Well, if we have agency and we're not really doing much with it, what does that mean? What does that imply about us?
I think we can draw a level of self-criticism from that.
I think it's okay. And then what if we still do nothing?
But that's still a choice, right?
So then we deserve it? We deserve what's happening.
I think partially
maybe we do. I'm just saying.
I don't know if we deserve everything. I don't know if I'm that cynical, but I think that it is our responsibility, and there is individual responsibility to take your fate into your own hands.
I think, regardless of your views on free will, which we both have certain views on it, I think there's no question that humans are very much influenced by their environment and different forces, you know, that are kind of out of our control.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's why marketing is so effective, right?
Sure. But
there's
also ways, like, your environment is always going to have an impact on you. Your environment, I mean, there are plenty of things that you don't have control over, but there are also some things that you do have control over. And at least in the United States right now, the capacity to vote is still a lever of power you can exercise.
We'll see for how long.
Right. Yeah. Yes. But it did impact this election cycle, you know? Like, objectively speaking, the majority of people voted a certain way for a certain reason. And I mean, I don't think the Democratic Party is going to do anything to really, you know, change, but it's still an exercise of agency. And I think it is a very empowering thing to recognize that we do hold a level of responsibility over who governs us and the kind of policies they pass. And somebody took that agency to the nth degree this week. And here we are.
There you go. I mean, that's the note to end on. It's like you have the agency to do really amazing things in this world. And so just utilize your agency
in a good way. You know?
By the way, for the record, we're not advocating for murder people. No. We're just saying that you have agency, and you know it is up to you how you use it, and do some good with it is the ultimate point. Avoid maybe start doomerism. A podcast. Start another podcast. I think we could use more.
Doomerism promotes the meta crisis.
Maybe. Well, with that. If you've enjoyed the conversation, of course, subscribe, leave a comment, let us know what you think.
Love hearing from you. Take care of yourselves. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.